Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia. This is Military Monday with your host, John Gresham. And we are going to go ahead and look at something that I think you're going to enjoy a great deal. Many people remember 40 years ago the homecoming for our POWs from North Vietnam and the incredible men and the stories that they brought with them of the savage torture, starvation, and sometimes even murder of their fellow POWs. And out of this have come just some legendary personalities, men who have been awarded the Medal of Honor for their actions, but more importantly, managed to keep something called the Code of Conduct, which are, if you will, the rules by which military personnel who are prisoners of war are expected to act and to maintain. Today we are going to be looking at this series of events through an interesting new book called Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton. This is a book which, quite simply in its most basic form, might be called a leadership and business management book, but in fact takes the time to go and examine, analyze, and encapsulate the secrets of the men who helped lead the POW population through their horrible experiences at the hands of the North Vietnamese, and in the end wound up triumphing on their own. We have today the authors of the book. These are Mr. Peter Fretwell and Mrs. Taylor Baldwin Killand of the Naval Institute Press, a fine little operation run off the campus of the Naval Academy. Peter and Taylor, are you there?
We're here.
Excellent, excellent. And I'd like to start a little by going ahead and introducing you to the listeners. Peter, tell us a little bit about yourself and what is your background to writing this book.
John, thank you for having us on your show. We appreciate it very much.
By
vocation, I'm a radio broadcaster. I manage the Classical Network out of central New Jersey. We serve the New York, Philadelphia, and all of New Jersey markets as classical broadcasters. By avocation, I am a person who just loves to study what makes organizations tick, what is going on in the system that works or doesn't work. And as I was in graduate school looking at Jim Collins' book, Good to Great, he mentioned the Stockdale Paradox. And from there, the story gets a little bit murkier, but that's how I met Taylor. I'll let her pick up and explain who she is and how she came to this topic.
Taylor, and what is your story?
What is my story? Come from a military family, a Navy family in particular. I'm third generation Navy and was raised part of my life in Coronado, California, which, as you know, John, is the home to several former POWs. And I have very, very distinctive memories of the homecoming of the POWs in 1973. I was 7 years old at the time and went to school with some of the POWs' kids. My mom was friends with some of the POW wives. I remember seeing the yellow ribbons and the homecoming posters, and it left a very, very indelible mark on my memory. And I volunteered for the John McCain campaign in his presidential campaign in the year 2000, and met a number of the former POWs who were campaigning on his behalf. My background is all PR and marketing, and I was responsible for setting up some media interviews for these POWs. And I was struck by the fact that the media never seemed to be interested in anything other than their time in captivity. They wanted to know if what they were fed and if they were tortured and whether or not their wives left them. And I remember sitting there scratching my head listening to these radio interviews, thinking to myself, these men have been home for 30-plus years. There must be some great life stories about how these men rebuilt their lives when they were given that second chance of freedom. And so I teamed up with a friend of mine, a photographer, Jamie Halloran, and we created a museum exhibit and a book called Open Doors, Vietnam POWs 30 Years Later, which was published in 2005.
So this is not a new subject to you.
It is not a new subject to me, no, not at all. And so I was moderating a panel of POWs on C-SPAN, and Pete actually saw me and contacted me, cold called me, and said to me on the phone, he told me a little bit about his background and that he wanted to write a book about the leadership lessons and business lessons that were gleaned from the POW's time in captivity. So that's how we met. And we actually worked together on the phone for about 3 years before we even met each other in person.
Which is the nature of modern book writing. Pete, I want to hear what you have to say regarding the origin of this book. And if you would, as part of that, answer the question, who is, or was in this case, James Bond Stockdale?
Wow. Can I just start there? Who was James
Sure.
Bond Stockdale? Well, Jim Collins talks in his book, Good to Great, about level five leaders. And I think if he brought anything to modern business thought, it's the fact that true top echelon leaders, world-class leaders, are not about themselves. They're about the mission. They're usually very humble. In some cases, they're introverts. They're very thoughtful. They're contemplative. They want to see their companies succeed long after they leave. There is an inclination in some would-be leaders to want the ship to crash after they leave to prove how good they were. You don't find that in a level five leader. And as I read Jim Collins and the Stockdale Paradox, I became intrigued by who is this man. So I bought Thoughts of a Philosophical Fighter Pilot, which was written by Stockdale for Hoover Institute out of Stanford. And frankly, John, didn't understand 90% of it. It was over my head. This man was a towering intellect. He was a philosophy major at Stanford, writing about Epictetus, the Greek Stoic philosopher. I had no clue how that had anything to do with what he and his men did. Despite that ignorance,
Jim Stockdale, when he was shot down in the mid-60s, was an air wing commander off of one of the carriers in the Gulf of Tonkin. He was one of the most senior people who had been shot down up to that point. And so automatically within the camp structure, not only was a POW, but was expected to provide leadership for the rest of the POW population around him.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting, too, that there were other senior officers with higher rank than him who chose not to step forward. When you want to talk about who James Bond Stockdale was, and I think even today is in his legacy, you're talking about a man of unusual intellect and courage and the willingness to just step into the fiery furnace. And to go through the gates of hell for his men. And he did that time and time and time again. As a matter of fact, if I had to summarize in a couple of sentences, this was a man who got knocked down, he would drag himself out, pull his shoulders back, and then he'd turn right around and go back through the gates of hell for his men. And he did that for 7.5 years.
And for this, of course, he was later rewarded with the decoration that we all speak of so highly, the Medal of Honor, which, if anything, he won several times over, along with, of course, the requisite Purple Heart. Might sound like not much for all those years in captivity, but what else are you going to do? You know, it tells the story. And for our other listeners, if you'd like to call in and talk to either myself or to our authors, our call-in number is 347-945-7246, and I see we have one caller already from out in California. Let's see if I can get him on the air. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, sure am.
And your name, sir?
Ed Beakley.
And what's your question?
Well, I've made contact with Taylor some weeks ago, right before the book came out, and it was actually because of an email recommendation from Orson Swindle, who is one of the people that's talked about in the book, and quotes from him, and he told me I needed to look at what she was doing. And long story short, in fact, Taylor and I exchanged emails this morning, and when I saw the LinkedIn note that you guys are up, I had the time, so I wanted to just make sure I heard what you guys were doing and just said hi to Taylor and make a comment that I think this may be one of the better books out there across the board on leadership given today's environment. I'm fairly knowledgeable about the story and the environment and the people. And indeed, I've got a blog where I've got seven parts on it related to Operation Homecoming, one of that being the couple of years ago piece that Taylor did in Naval Institute. And I'm a retired naval aviator, and my squadron was one of the only one, as far as I know, that had the POW names under our names on the side of the cockpit. And the last guy that John McCain talked to before he often got shot down was my CO, Lou Chatham, and that 72 cruise. And then on his airplane, his best friend was Paul Galati. So, really, excellent book. I think it hits some things that just aren't going to be found. And Taylor, I had asked Taylor about whether he was going to do a coursework developed. She said they were looking at the environment. And I just will throw one thought out there for you. If you look at Katrina, you're looking at a captive environment. And it doesn't take very much to step from one environment to the other and see what the connectivity with all the things, the lessons that you've got in the book. Excellent job, guys. I've been looking at this for a long time, and I always use the term isolated but unified. And I think you just nailed it.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for your comments, and let's let the authors respond back. Thank you for calling. Taylor, Peter, thoughts?
Well, Ed's right. I have been corresponding with him quite a bit. It's nice to actually hear your voice, Ed. You made a comment in your email to me this morning that sometimes it's hard when individuals are in the midst of the environment to actually step back and see some of the lessons. And we hope that we've provided some perspective that maybe the POWs being so close to the experience were not able to sort of wrap their arms around. We spent many interviews with the POWs where we asked them, how did you do what you did? And most of them just kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it was instinct. It took a lot of research and thoughtful questions to tease out some of the lessons and some of the anecdotes from them about how they applied these lessons while in captivity and subsequent to their homecoming. Pete, any comments?
Well, one thing in Ed's email to you this morning just jumped out at me. He said he was going from Honor Bound, which is the definitive history done by the Secretary of the Navy's office, Stuart Rochester and Frederick Kiley, I think in the late 80s, wasn't it, early 90s?
Something like that.
Voluminous history, the official history of the POWs in Southeast Asia. He keeps jumping from it to our book and seeing it from a different perspective once these six characteristics of a high-performance team are kind of laid bare. And I think Ed nailed there a really good pairing of honor-bound is what they did. Our book tries to explain in general lay terms how they did it.
Yeah.
And putting the two side by side is actually an incredibly powerful lesson in courage, honor, duty, how organizations work, how the human mind works, all of the above.
Taylor, talk a little more about the two of you getting together and evolving towards the actual writing of this book for Naval Institute.
You want to hear about the fights or you want to hear about...
Oh, let's lay the dirty laundry right out there on the front porch. Go for it, guys. Tell me what you care to share.
Well, as I mentioned, Pete cold called me and said, you know, I have an idea for a book about the POWs. I've written a monograph or a thesis about these POWs, but I don't have the relationships with the POWs. And based on the work that you've done in your previous book, would you like to collaborate? And I was all open to collaborating, but I'll be honest with you. I said to Pete, you know, I think this is an oversaturated genre. I said, if you walk into any bookstore or look on Amazon, there are leadership lessons or business lessons from the military all over the place. There's lessons from, you know, Genghis Khan and lessons from, you know,
a personal favorite, by the way. Yeah.
I'm going to let Pete take over. I have to jump onto a different phone. So if you give me 5 minutes, I will call right back in.
Please do.
Okay.
Okay.
Pete, go for it.
Taylor is the mother of a newborn who is the most beautiful young lady you will ever meet. Keeland Hatcher is her name, and I suspect that she probably is doing some motherly duties right now, but it's really cool to watch. We did a lot of conversing, as she mentioned earlier, John, for 3 years on the phone, working on this, researching, talking, sending drafts back and forth. And when we finally published an article in Naval Proceedings in 2009...
Which I believe was in 2009, as I recall.
It was, yeah. Within 48 hours, Taylor got summoned to the Pentagon. Four-star general wanted to talk about this topic. Well, that
and we can say his name now since he's retired. It was, in fact, no less than Wild Dog Mattis.
That's it.
The famous Marine general.
And he wanted to talk about resilience and how do we take some of the character qualities and the lessons from the Hanoi Hilton and how do we, if you will, infiltrate those into today's military. He was deeply concerned as a leader should be, about seeing to it that his men and women coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan were able to bounce back like these POWs did. And that really gave us a sense of vision of what this book could accomplish. And I tend to agree that Taylor was right on the front end in saying that business and leadership books are a dime a dozen. They literally are. 1,000 of them come out every year. Somebody did us a favor along the way and pushed us over, not by their intent, but just by how life happens, pushed us over a couple of notches from business and leadership. And I know that Naval Institute Press has categorized this as a business and leadership book, but if you look at it on Amazon, they actually peg it more accurately. It's listed under organizational change and organizational, I think, systems or some other arcane word. That's actually what the book's about. It's about organizational culture, how teams, including the mindset of the followers, affect whether you reach your goal, whether you achieve your mission. And that's where the focus of the book really ended up, is how did these 591 men in the Hanoi Hilton achieve their mission when their leader, James Von Stockdale, was actually incommunicado from them more than 4 years out of the 7.5. The North Vietnamese kept him isolated as best they could. They beat him to a pulp 15 times. He was tortured. And yet, somehow the organization kept the mission and the values intact and kept moving forward. That's remarkable.
Needless to say, and how much had you written about Stockdale prior to proposing to Taylor that you would do this book?
I had written my book, John, and it was a booklet. It would have made a good sized leaflet. I could have stood on the street corner and handed out 10 copies of it before I ran out of, you know.
In respectable society, we would have called it a pamphlet.
That's it, a pamphlet. It was a reasonable attempt based on the fact that I was dealing just from Stockdale's writing and my own background in business and organizational management and systems. It was when I picked up Taylor's book, Open Doors, after seeing, my wife saw her on C-SPAN and said, you got to come see this lady. And Taylor was interviewing the POWs on a live C-SPAN broadcast. I think it was Veterans Day 2005 or 6. And as I got her book and started reading through it, one paragraph jumped out at me toward the end of the book. She and Jamie delineated what had happened to this group as a whole over the 30 ensuing years at that point, 17 or 18 of them had become flag officers, 7 members of Congress, 1 vice presidential candidate, a federal trade commissioner, the first ambassador back to Vietnam, appointed by Bill Clinton, Pete Peterson, back to Vietnam when we normalized relations with Vietnam again. The list went on and on and on. And at that point, you don't have to be a business genius to say, something's going on here. When you bring home 100 people or 500 people from 7 years of torture and isolation and deprivation, and they go on to that type of a track record collectively, they outperform any single graduating class from Princeton, Harvard, or Yale, something happened there. What was it? And that's what fed the book.
Now, you finally convinced her through whatever means. And you did, of course, have the remarkable feedback. I remember reading it in the months after your article was published in Proceedings. You had this remarkable stream of feedback, obviously the fact that she got called to the Pentagon to talk to no less than Jim Mattis about this. And so this must have provided an excellent jump start to where you were going at this point.
It did. I think when she's off the phone, it's a good time to talk about her, John. The thing that really made this work is Taylor Baldwin Keeland is an incredible worker, incredible networker. She's an incredible person who is deeply loved by these POWs. She and her family command deep respect. She didn't mention it, but her grandfather served in the Navy in both World War I and II, received the Navy Cross. He retired as an admiral, a flag officer from the Navy. Her father was career Navy. I think he was in the same Naval Academy class as Dr. J.P. London, which is the connection there. Taylor is incredibly well-networked, well-loved, well-respected, and she has a work ethic that puts me to shame. And it was that truly ground this through the process of going from concept to being a book that has gravitas.
Well, I hope that you'll come back on and talk to us again some more here. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that book.
Okay.
You talked about there being 6 guiding principles that you attempt to illustrate in the book. Talk a little bit about those, if you will.
Okay. First one is the mission leads. And this was, for me, the single most surprising one. I did not see it coming till it just reached out and slapped me in the face. I can take you to the moment that it happened. I'm walking through my living room. My wife is listening to Books on Tape of the Halliburton Cherry story, Two Souls Indivisible. And Halliburton's talking about the fact that he's in the cell next to James Stockdale, and Stockdale is tapping to him, "Here's what I want you to tell my wife. I don't think I'm going to make it." I stopped.
And it's worth noting, this is an extraordinary lady in her own right. Sybil Stockdale is just an incredible human being, as you well know.
She is. She is, absolutely. And I stopped mid-living room and thought, wait a minute. I've been researching this now for 4 or 5 years, and here is Halliburton speaking from the past, a book long ago written, something that has never really registered in my mind. James Bond Stockdale didn't expect to make it home. What does that mean? And I started stepping back and thinking through the systemic implications of that, and the more evidence I started looking for in that area, the more clear it became, back to Jim Collins and the Level 5 leader, the mission leads. A sustainable, high-performance culture, like they created in the Hanoi Hilton, has to be mission-centric. It cannot be leader-centric. And we all know would-be leaders who think it's all about them. And as Stockdale understood that if he didn't make it, the other POWs had to make it. And he started from the basic underlying philosophical premise that if the mission has value and purpose, the followers can continue on. Someone else can slide into the leader's seat, and people will keep moving forward. And that's what he did. He created a mission-centric culture.
Taylor, are you back on with us?
I'm here.
Excellent, excellent. I just wanted to make sure you had gotten back in. What are a couple of the other principles, in addition to what Peter was just saying that you wanted to emphasize, from especially from your point of view as one of the authors?
Well, one of the most important ones, and it's listed as number two, is you are your brother's keeper. We found that that term was actually something that Stockdale reiterated a number of times. A lot of times the POWs would reach out to Stockdale and ask for guidance when they were in a particularly tough situation. They would ask him, you know, we keep going into these interrogation sessions, boss. You know, what should we take torture for? What is worth taking torture for? They obviously didn't have any significant intelligence information. After being in captivity for 2 or 3 days, really their intelligence value was lost. And the North Vietnamese knew that. These POWs were propaganda tools. So what they wanted to do was try and break these men. And torture was their way of doing that. So the POWs would turn to Stockdale repeatedly and say, you know, God, you know, they keep asking these ridiculous questions. What are we taking torture for? What is the importance of our mission here? And Stockdale would say, you know, take care of your fellow man. Take care of your brother. You are your brother's keeper. And it really was a perfect example for us of what in leadership circles is talked about, servant leadership, that really as a servant leader, you are responsible for taking care of your flock. And he reiterated that time and time again, that you know, a really powerful organization and its leaders are ones that protect their followers. They create a culture and an environment of inclusion, honesty, second chances, and really, really taking care of the needs of others before themselves. You don't see that much that often in today's business circles. You really, really don't. You really more often see leaders taking care of their own needs before their subordinates.
It's funny, but what the two of you have just described in the previous two answers are the very beginnings of what you would expect to hear in a Medal of Honor citation. Having written a book on the Medal of Honor myself, the words above and beyond are right at the beginning of it, and that's what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
You're taking the extra step, and you're giving of yourself, not caring about the possible personal consequences of it.
Right.
Absolutely right.
Pete, talk a little more about some of the other principles that you guys put into this book.
For me, the one that is probably day-to-day in my work environment most important, and I'm going to jump ahead here to number 5, keeping the faith is the way Taylor summarized this, but it's an all-inclusive category that says a sustainable high-performance team is dominated by two things, rational beliefs and optimism. By rational beliefs, we mean the fact that you step back from what you're feeling and you assess very coldly and very logically what's going on and what your response needs to be. You don't give in to fear or panic or the taste of the day as far as what's going around the compound. You remain rational. Optimism is not standing in a circle and singing kumbaya. It is actually an assessed thing that we learned from the Robert Mitchell POW Center down in Florida. Optimists are people who believe that whatever they're facing, setbacks, failures, it's temporary, it's local, and it's external to them. It is not permanent, it is not pervasive, and it's not personal. It's not about them. And the people who are able to overcome whatever they're going through have optimism in the sense that they understand it's temporary, it's external to them, and it is local. It's not going to ruin their life, it's not going to last forever, and it's not because they did something wrong.
And I'll chime in here. Sorry for interrupting, Pete.
No. We want to hear both of you.
Is that Stockdale said there's a difference between failing and being a failure. And he meant that in the context of torture and interrogation sessions, because many times the POWs would give up more information. They would reach their breaking point either physically or mentally and would give up information that their interrogators were asking for. Usually it was ridiculous information, meaningless information, but on principle they felt like they had failed the code of conduct. And they would come back to their cell and they would not only be physically hurting, but they would be emotionally distraught that they had let their fellow POWs down and let their country down. And Stockdale said, hey, you know, there are no virgins here. We all have given up information. We've all have reached our varying breaking points. But the difference is, the difference between us and other POWs, other POW cultures, is that we're going to get back up on our feet. We're going to bounce back.
Yeah, and you both bring up good points, which is the Vietnam POW experience was vastly different from that of World War II with the Italians and the Germans, which were the largest POW populations America ever put out, except for possibly the American Civil War. Between the two of you, try and encapsulate for our listeners, what was that experience like day-to-day, week to week, and year to year? Give us a sense of, it's morning, and what does Jim Stockdale have to look forward to along with all of the hundreds of other men who are there with him?
Wow, that's a great question. You want to tackle it, Taylor?
I was hoping you would.
I'll tackle it. I think the answer to that, John, is simple.
Hello?
I think we may have lost Jim.
We may have lost him. Pete.
Well, we'll hope he'll call back in. And Taylor, you got the ball.
Okay. I can tell you that one of the POWs, his name is Captain Everett Southwick. He's actually on the cover of my first book about the POWs, Open Doors. And he described the POW experience as days and weeks of months and months of sheer boredom, interspersed by moments of sheer terror.
In other words, torture was a way of life for these people. They would expect it after a period of time.
Yes, they absolutely would. But there were long, long intermittent periods of sheer boredom. You know, I wasn't there. I can't speak for them, but those are some of the things that I've heard them say. That's really what their days were like, and that was changed at the latter part of the war, after the Paris Peace Accords were signed in January of 73. Most of the POWs.
And of course, there was a small transition after the Santé raid back in the early 70s as well.
Correct. So by the mid to late 70s, and especially after January of 73, most of the POWs were, or almost all of them, were collected and brought together into larger groups of, you know, 40 to 70 apiece. And so their daily lifestyle really, really changed then. There was just much more social activity and camaraderie, you know, because they were physically together.
Jim, have we got you? I mean, Peter, have we got you back?
You do.
Excellent. Sorry, we had a small technology burp there. Pick up where Taylor left off. We were talking about the daily life of the POWs in Vietnam. What kind of food did they get, and what kind of clothes did they wear, and what were their conditions in terms of detention within the camps?
You know, we did not talk very long with most of the POWs, John, about food and day-to-day conditions, because that had been written about a lot. And the thing that kept coming to mind whenever the topic kind of came to the front burner was something that Jim Stockdale wrote about that in Thoughts of a Philosophical Fighter Pilot. He said, when people asked me what we ate or what it was like, you know, in the cell, he said that was the furthest thing from our mind. And I think that's true. This team got to where what was shoved in by the turnkey, the person who unlocked their cell door and slid their food trays in, didn't matter to them a lot. I gather that it was oftentimes just things like soup and pretty jail gruel, if you will. But it didn't matter a lot to them at some point. What mattered more was the guy in the cell next to them. So we didn't talk about that a lot with them. It's pretty clear from some of the photos and some of the Michael Martin drawings and so on that it was very severe, particularly in the first years, 1964 to, say, 1970, 71. They were tough times, extremely tough times. As Taylor said toward the end of her answer, it eased off and changed from 1971 to 73.
And that said, morale, you talk about these leadership lessons and there being a culture that develops around it. And we talked today about command or management cultures within organizations. What kind of culture evolved as a result of all those years together with these men?
Taylor?
By the end of their captivity, they were an incredibly unified group of men. One of our last lessons is something we call the power of we. These men had become so unified and so consistent in their response to their captors. We tell a story about something called the Kissinger 20. It's a really fascinating story. When the Paris Peace Accords were signed, and the POWs, or the North Vietnamese, were arranging the POWs to be sent home. POWs were very insistent that it was first man in, first man out. And so the longest held POW was to be released first, and that the POWs...
That being Everett Alvarez, who had been taken down in 64, correct?
He was the longest held in North Vietnam. There was actually one POW held in South Vietnam who was held a little bit longer. His last name was Thompson. But that being said, they were released in groups every couple of weeks starting in February, and they were released in the order in which they were shot down. So the longest held were released first. Ed Meckenbeier, Major General Ed Meckenbeier, tells a story about how he was being lined up and put into a group for release, and he looked around at the guys who were being released with him, and he realized that they were being moved up in the pecking order and were being released before they were supposed to be released. And they were scratching their heads saying, you know, why is this? And so when it came time for them to actually walk out the door, they refused. And they said to their captors, we will not go before the guys who were held longer than we were. And they were insistent about it. And they resisted for 5 additional days. And finally, the North Vietnamese actually had to call an American to come over and order Meckenbeier and these 20 to leave. And when they got on the plane, they said to them, you know, what were you doing in there? Why were you resisting for 5 days? He says, well, you know, we had a mission. It was return with honor. And that meant that we don't leave before the guy who's been held longer than we have leaves. And to us, to Pete and me, in hearing that story, it was just so symbolic of the unity of that group and how dedicated they were to the mission, that even when freedom was within grasp, they could reach out and touch it, they could reach out and taste it, they were not going to violate or betray the mission. A little side story, Meckenbeier said he found out later that the North Vietnamese had given Secretary Kissinger a little carrot and had said, you choose 20 POWs to be released. And Meckenbauer said he looked down at the names of the 20 that were supposed to be released, and they all had German names. So he thinks that Kissinger went through the list and just randomly picked guys that sounded German.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
It sounds terribly Kissinger, is all I can say, having been a Washington resident for a few years.
But
and a
you know,
great
that's
story.
Not the important part of the story is that, you know, that mission was so ingrained in them, so ingrained, and they all bought into it. They all embraced it. We call it the power of we. I mean, who wouldn't want to have that kind of dedication in their company or their organization?
Oh,
they
who wouldn't like that as their best friend, you know?
Absolutely.
They all, each one of them, found both personal and organizational meaning in what they were trying to achieve. And that, to us, is the power of we. Paul Galanti, by the way, coined that term. We just
and it's an excellent term. Now, Pete, we were talking just now about the culture of the POWs. But let's talk a little bit about another piece of that culture, and that is there is nothing that Americans love to do more than talk among themselves. Mm-hmm. Personal communications one-on-one is, for example, at the core of the present social media revolution, some would say crisis. I mean, you know, can we get people's heads out of the Twitter at times? And in the camps, especially when the individual prisoners were separated and kept in cells in isolation, they still had a way to communicate. Talk a little bit about something called the TAP code and what it meant to this population.
Okay. The TAP code was a simple 5x5 matrix. If you envision five squares up, five squares across, put A in the upper left-hand corner, go A, B, C, D, E, F across the top, and then G, H, you know, across, and leave out either C or K. They're interchangeable. You have a 25-symbol matrix and a TAP of, if I can do this here, that 1-1 means first square or first row, first letter, which is A. If you drop down to the second row, it would be two taps followed by 1. That's G. And they became amazingly quick at this. They said one person, I don't remember who, perhaps Taylor does, told us they could exchange 5,000 words a day. Now think about that. You're basically doing a revised Morse code, tapping out 5,000 words a day. But they got so quick at it, they would do shorthand. GBU is God bless you. You would say that to somebody who was headed into torture. You'd say it last thing at night before you, if you will, put down your tin cup and stop tapping. This became the means by which they communicated. If you couldn't tap, you would sweep the courtyard using the TAP code. You would do flashing between cell windows with the TAP code.
Or you would cough.
You would cough, yeah. They found ways to communicate. And to kind of, if you will, to play off what Taylor was talking about in the power of we, they argued. They debated. They were distinct individuals, 590-some of them by the time they came out. And they remained individuals through this, and the TAP code was how they did it. They would carry on debates with the TAP code. They would carry on discussions. They would teach each other. One of the POWs learned Spanish by the TAP code. How do you do that? Amazing stuff.
So the TAP code was very literally the Twitter of their day between them.
Well said. Well said. Absolutely. It was, Twitter, I think, has a 140 character limit or something like that.
Right.
Your
message,
knuckles.
Yes.
Yeah. Your knuckles would get calluses on them, and you would get tired of holding your cup up to the cell wall, but that is how you communicated, in short bursts, and then pass it on if it was important, if it was an order, if it was a policy, you passed it on. If it was just you and the guy next to you carrying on, passing on sports scores, passing on opinion, whatever it might, you know, Dick Statton said that he came to love what he called the boat school boys, Naval Academy grads. because even though they could disagree with the old man, meaning either Stockdale, Reisner, or Denton, the top three real leaders, if you will, or the senior-ranking officer in their particular section of the prison, even if you disagreed with them, a boat school boy would pass it on and then come around later and debate it with you. But their first order of business was get it out through the ranks, get on the wall.
Yeah. Get on the wall was a term that was used frequently by the POWs. And we should also mention that the TAP code was prolific, and it was ubiquitous, and it was frequently used, but it was also highly risky to use it. They were punished if they were caught using it, and they were caught using it a lot. So it sounds like it was maybe difficult to learn but easy to use. It was challenging for them to use it because of the risks of getting caught.
And yet this is one of the things that helped them maintain a cohesive, if you will, state within the camps at themselves. I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm going, what is, again, as I said earlier, what is more American than wanting to know mm-hmm. what's going on and being
right.
able to reach out and connect?
Right.
And I'm trying to think, was there anything more important in a lot of ways?
No, not at all.
No, we call it their social network, and that was the tool that helped to promulgate that social network. But it was critical.
Think about it from an organizational. Go into the average office there inside the Beltway, John, and information is used as power. It's kept from certain people so that you can have an edge over them. It's used for competitive purposes. It is oftentimes used to disrupt that which you disagree with. The POWs, in a sense, had an advantage here in that they knew that they had to work together or they would individually succumb to their environment. I think it was George Coker who told us, he said, you know, we really had a lot of advantages. We had no vacation time. We had no family issues. We didn't have to mow the lawn. We had just 7 years of getting through that with our honor intact. That's all we had to focus our energy on.
One last question regarding the book. You list a couple of other people who have contributed to the book. Obviously, they wrote forewords and introductions. Dr. J.P. London and Dr. Stockdale. Can you talk a little bit about the two of them and their contributions to the work you two did together?
Sure. Dr. London, who is the chairman of CACI International, a defense contractor, multi-billion dollar publicly traded defense contractor based here in Washington. He has had a lifelong interest in the POWs. He, too, was a military aviator in Vietnam, but he was not a POW. He has admired these men for a very long time. And I actually approached him and asked him if he would like to contribute to the book because of his lifelong interest in the POWs. And we also felt it would be worthwhile to have a CEO on the cover of the book to add some CEO credibility. And so he participated in a lot of the interviews, did some editing, and contributed a foreword. And then we were introduced to Dr. Jim Stockdale, the second, Admiral Stockdale's oldest son. We were introduced to him through the Stockdale Center for Ethical Studies at the Naval Academy. They suggested that we reach out to him, and because he is sort of the keeper of the family flame. And we cold called him and asked if he would like to be involved in the book. He read the first manuscript and said, I think you've hit the nail on the head, and he contributed another foreword for the book and is also going to help us develop some educational curriculum for the book.
Outstanding. I just want to say that I really appreciate the work that you two have put into this subject and the clearly new direction that you've gone in looking at the POW experience from an analytic point of view and trying to pick apart the elements that allowed them to survive, the habits, the tendencies, and such. That said, what are each of you doing now? What are you going to be doing next and in the future? And Pete, let's start with you, if you don't mind.
Well, I was hoping to retire somewhere, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But I think, actually, for me, the mission ahead, and the reason I'm so excited to have Jim Stockdale II on board with us, is I believe deeply in these lessons. I believe that one of the great gifts from these POW heroes to America is these simple and yet incredibly difficult lessons to infect our families, our nonprofits, our businesses, our synagogues and churches, and to learn from them of how to take what we are going to be doing anyway and to take it to the next level and to be everything we can be, to see the mission that we started out with as a teacher or as a minister or as a mother or father or as a radio show host, to take it to the level that we're capable of. And for me, that's really the next phase, is to take this message out and to share it wherever and however. Not because this is not about Taylor or Pete. This is about the lessons from the Hanoi Hilton.
And what form do you see those taking? You mentioned the idea of an educational program of some kind involving leadership training using the lessons. How do you see that coming about, and what else do you see coming into your future?
Well, I'm not a fortune teller, but I will echo Pete's sentiments that we are still trying to see what sort of demand there might be for education as it relates to this book, ongoing training, whether it's secondary school level or continuing education or professional development within the military. But in the meantime, we just hope to speak to as many different groups as possible about the book, and not necessarily the book, but the concepts in the book. As any of you who have published a book know, and I know you have, John, there's not a whole lot of money in writing books. but there is.
Sadly.
Right. But
considering the effort that goes into it, you'd think there would be, but no, there really isn't.
No. But, you know, as I have said to many people, we have to remember that this group of POWs was and still are, I mean, were and still are, the longest-held group of POWs in our nation's history. No other group of POWs from any other war has ever been held as long. And yet they came home, and as a group, intact, unified, with honor, with their reputations and their heads held high, and went on to pursue incredibly successful professional careers. And they have a lifetime incidence of PTSD, on average, of 4%, which, if I have said before, is freakishly low. So I call them a national treasure. They are just poster children for resilience and success after a particularly traumatic event.
John, James Stockdale II told us something that I had not known about this. When his father's book came out, In Love and War, I don't remember what year it came out, one of the first phone calls he got was from Bill Walsh of the San Francisco 49ers, who invited him up for lunch. They sat down over lunch, and they became close personal friends for the remainder of Jim Stockdale's life. He would sometimes fly on the 49ers plane with him to a game. And I said, well, what did they talk about? Did they talk about the lessons from? He said, no, they were just personal friends. But I think Bill Walsh, as a championship coach of a professional football team, understood inherently that the things that James Stockdale and the other POWs learned and did inside the Hanoi Hilton for up to 8-9 years were things of innate value, inherent value, to championship athletes, to mothers, fathers, business leaders, to nonprofit organizations. There's just value there.
And it takes us to one final question, and I'm going to throw this to both of you, and I'd like to hear both of your thoughts. Did our POWs win on the inside? Were they victorious over their captors?
They absolutely did. They absolutely won their war. Stockdale used to remind the POWs, hey, you're no longer flying jets or bombers. You're no longer responsible for bombing missions over North Vietnam, but you are still in the war. You're fighting a different battle, and it's the propaganda battle. And he was very, very specific and gave them tools, as well as an overall mission. He gave them tools as to how to fight that battle. But he said the most important thing is that we come home, that we return with honor, unified in our resistance. And they did. They beat their captors at their own game. It's one of the few success stories, but one of the few highlights of the Vietnam War.
Pete, what are your thoughts in addition to what Taylor said?
I would second her absolutely. They absolutely and completely won their war, not without casualties, not without injury, not without paying a drastically high price. To this day, you will still see the physical scars. And despite the low PTSD, you will also see that they carry with them emotional scars from it. You don't go through what they went through without pain coming along with you through the rest of your life. But perhaps most importantly, not only did they emerge victorious, they emerged with a huge gift to any human being, not just Americans, but any human being who is willing to turn and look with open eyes and open mind at what they achieved and how they achieved it. They brought back a huge gift for other people who want to take their situation and change it for the better for the future. You can have virtually no resources, just your brain and your tin cup, and you can achieve something worth noting in life if you're willing to look at what these men learned.
Again, one last question before we close up for both of you. Do you think they've forgiven the men who tortured them, the activists who used them, and the Americans who didn't support them? Do you feel like they've forgiven them for those actions and moved on to better things in their lives?
That is a good question. They've definitely... they've definitely gotten over the experience. I couldn't speak for them. You'd have to ask them individually if they've forgiven their torturers and their captors.
I think Pete Peterson is an example of someone who clearly articulated to us that he not only had, he went back to Vietnam as the first ambassador.
That
is
true.
And actively worked to make that country everything he believed it could be.
That is true. But I have also heard John McCain say on the campaign trail that he would never forgive his individual captors.
Right.
So I think it probably varies. But do they harbor bitterness about the experience? I think collectively they don't. Most of them would tell you that while they wouldn't want to go through the experience again, they grew emotionally from the experience.
Well, when you live on, not even on the edge, but in the middle of depravity, it is an enlightening experience.
That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right?
Yes, and as we all know, these are a very strong group of men. I want to thank you both for coming on today and giving us a great, great show. I hope your book continues to do well. I know it's been getting a fair amount of publicity out in the national press, and I'm hoping you'll go and appear on lots more shows like this and can continue to tell the story of these great, great Americans. Please, I hope I get to have a reason to go ahead and bring you both back on someday in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
All right, and with that, we're going to close out this edition of Military Monday. I will tell you that next week we have a show scheduled with another U.S. Naval Institute author and a wonderful friend of mine, Dr. Thomas Hone, And we'll be talking about the Battle of Midway, which was America's greatest naval victory, and his new book, which he edited for Naval Institute on that subject. Until then, have a great week, stay safe, and please come looking for us again on Military Monday next week. Bye-bye.